Welcome to Charting the Course, a podcast from Full Sail Capital, dedicated to providing you with insights, assurance, and confidence to grow and manage generational wealth. Full Sail Capital is a fiduciary registered investment advisor managing more than $1 billion with a focus on integrity, competency, and transparency.
Tyler and I are joined by Zach Reynolds to record another Squirtoway episode. In this episode, we hear from Zach about the effects of inflation, its potential impact, and steps investors can take. I know you'll enjoy our conversation and hope it serves you along your journey. Zach, we're back here again for another Squirtoway episode to talk primarily about inflation. Given the difficulty in keeping this topic in a silo, we're sure to cross over into other areas of investing. But first things first, what are we talking about when we talk about inflation?
Just put simply, inflation is an increase in the overall price level in the economy. When economists think about inflation, they think there are really two main types. So the first type is cost push inflation. Second type is demand pull inflation. Cost push inflation comes from an increase in input costs. So think about the oil crisis back in the 1970s when oil prices spiked and that pushed up prices in all sorts of goods and services. Lumber prices earlier this year increased quite a bit, pushing up housing prices. So that's the first type. The second type, demand pull inflation, occurs when an economy is expanding more quickly than anticipated, and then the production can't meet demand. You think about scarcity in vehicles or beach vacation rentals this summer. So far, we're seeing a little bit of both, the cost push and demand pull inflation.
So I hear a lot about reflation and deflation. Where do those fit into this conversation here?
Deflation is just the opposite of inflation. It's a general decrease in prices. Most economists today consider deflation as a very bad outcome, a very risky outcome. In fact, if you think back to the last two crises we've had, the global financial crisis back in 2008, 2009, and then coronavirus in 2020, what you've seen central banks and governments do is in direct response to trying to avoid the mistakes that were made back during the Great Depression, when governments tightened monetary policy, which led to deflation. So we've taken the opposite approach the last two crises, and we've pumped tons of money into the economy. I think it's maybe still a little too early to give out grades, but at least over the last 10 years, you can say that the outcome turned out better than a lot of economists would have expected because we haven't had much inflation over the last 10 years, and the economy was able to come back. In a deflationary environment, cash is worth tomorrow more than it's worth today. So that, of course, leads to bad incentives. That leads to people hoarding cash instead of spending it. Reflation, on the other hand, is when fiscal or monetary policy is used to try to help an economy expand output after a period of contraction. You think about a balloon that has an air leak. The idea is you pump some air back into it to get it filled back up. After the coronavirus crisis, the U.S. and other governments, central banks, they took reflationary actions to help prop up the global economy.
In your analogy there, do you need to plug the leak in the balloon first? Does that really matter, or is that kind of outside the scope of the analogy?
I think you try to do both. I think that's, you know, if you think, use 2020 as an example here, you know, governments were trying to mitigate the spread of the pandemic. We were trying to come up with vaccines, and we were also at the same time trying to help people who were out of work because the government shut down the global economy. At least in a crisis like that, you have to take all those actions at once.
So inflation is almost always spoken of in negative terms. Does it have any inherent moral quality? Is inflation always a bad thing?
I think there's a school of thought that may be popular in the far libertarian circles that would consider inflation similar to theft, just like some people think about taxation as theft.
Yep.
You know, regardless of how you feel about it, as an investor or someone managing money, you have to deal with it. It's just the reality of the situation. No one was born with some inalienable right to have their dollars worth tomorrow the same as they're worth today. That's not the way the world works. Inflation is not always bad. The Federal Reserve targets about a 2% inflation rate. They think that's a level, and many economists agree, that incentivizes growth and investment. So if you know your dollars are not going to be worth the same amount tomorrow as they are today, you have a strong incentive to go put them to work. So you might go stick them in a bank if they pay you an interest rate. You might buy a CD, you might invest in a longer-term government bond, stocks, you might start a business. All those things are good. And so that's the idea behind wanting some low, reasonable level of inflation. The Federal Reserve's mandate is stable prices and full employment. they consider stable prices steadily inflating prices yep. over time, not staying the same level.
So the common answer to the cause of inflation is government overspending. How much do you agree with that statement? Again, very non-nuanced, but how much do you agree with that? And how much does that affect the way that you invest client money for the long term?
Government spending or printing of currency can definitely cause inflation. We've seen that in Germany post-World War I. We've seen it in Zimbabwe. They printed $1 trillion bills there. I have one at home. It did not cost $1 trillion, U.S. dollars. But inflation can come from other areas too. So you think about U.S. housing market in the mid-2000s. Banks mm-hmm. loosened their lending standards, which allowed a lot more people to qualify for loans. That led to a big increase in demand, and therefore you had inflation in housing prices. As you sit here today, you know, the government has approved more than $5.3 trillion in spending in response to the pandemic. So we've never seen government spending on that scale. So, you know, there's not a perfect historical analogy, corollary that we can look back on, but it's certainly reasonable to me that if we create a lot of money, the government spends a lot of money, and then we have booming demand, that you're very likely to see an increase in the level of prices.
So you kind of bracketed it a little bit, but you said the Fed targets 2% inflation, and then you mentioned Weimar Republic, Germany, Zimbabwe level. So we're somewhere in between those two. So just kind of give me some metrics for what you're considering an inflationary environment.
Over a long period of time, about 3% inflation is, I think, considered normal. You know, that's looking back over the last, let's call it 100 years. That does include some periods of very high inflation, particularly late 70s, early 80s, mm-hmm. Which I think is why the Fed would tell you 2% is a number they're more comfortable with. If you look back over the last decade or so, we've been in that 1% to 2% inflation range. In fact, the Fed would like to see it a little bit higher. An inflationary environment to me, and I think most kind of market watchers these days, would be if we saw 3.5%, 4%, 5% inflation over a sustained period of time. I think we would probably see some negative effects to that. Most notably, would be likely to see interest rates start to really increase and potentially increase rapidly if there was a real inflation surprise. And if interest rates increase rapidly, you're very likely to see stock prices fall. You're going to see bond prices fall because they fall when interest rates go up. And then you're going to have increased borrowing costs for businesses and consumers. That can lead to lower prices on other asset classes like real estate. So it could have some negative cascading effects.
For simplifying assumptions, let's assume that occurs. And again, the prediction on that is very difficult to make, but let's just make a simplifying assumption and that occurs. And let's walk through a couple of different asset classes and why they would benefit or the drawbacks of investing there. So in an inflationary environment that you described, why wouldn't I just hold on to my cash and ride this thing out?
A lot of people feel like cash is a safe investment. And certainly if you've got $100,000 and you stick it in your safe, you're going to have $100,000 tomorrow. In an inflationary environment, though, that that feeling of safety is not accurate. Cash is a very bad investment in an inflationary environment. It's losing its purchasing power over time. And then your other options there would be whether you hold physical cash or you take it and put it in the bank. Historically speaking, when interest rates were more normalized, you might be able to get some return on your cash in the bank through just an interest rate. Mm-hmm. With the Fed anchoring short-term rates at zero today, whether you hold physical cash or you put it in the bank, your expected return is very close to zero either way. So it just makes cash a very bad investment.
Okay, so for instance, like, what's the money market rate right now? That's a nice benchmark people like to look at.
Yeah.
I'm in a money market, so I'm making some money, but I'm not exposed to the market.
Yeah, so money market rates are driven by the Fed funds rate. And the Fed funds rate right now is anchored at 0 to 0.25%. Money market for most clients and through our relationship with Fidelity Investments is paying not quite zero, but very close to zero, around 0.01.
To your point, we've had this conversation a lot around holding cash. I think there's, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but one thing I try to tell clients on the relationship managing side is holding some cash, as you know, you can call it the emergency fund, like the Ramsey approach. That's what I call it. Just having some cash on hand, it never is a bad idea. It's when we get above that and when we start to hoard cash, if you will, it can be 1% inflation, it can be 3% inflation. You're going to lose in the long run.
Tyler, I totally agree with that. I think some level of cash that anticipates your needs over the short term, 3 months, 6 months, yes, you're going to lose a little bit of value, but you're not exposing that money to other sorts of risk. So there's, you know, there's risk whatever you do, but I think that makes a lot of sense. It's when, you know, when Dexter and I get a portfolio in and let's say it's $1 million and there are no liquidity needs. So we don't, the client tells us, hey, we're not going to need this money. That's kind of when Dexter and I really consider cash to be a poor investment because we recognize it's not going to give us any return. And in fact, we're very likely to have negative real returns when you take into account the effect of inflation. So even though if we saw an inflation spike, you might see prices of stocks and bonds decline. That historically has been a short-term phenomenon, right? And we would expect still to see bonds and stocks outperform cash, outperform inflation over a long period of time, even though over shorter periods of time, you could have a different result.
So in terms of holding on to assets, the another option would be gold. And this is a time whenever it's really going to shine, pun intended, correct?
Yeah, a lot of people think that. It's a really common belief. I've really spent a lot of time looking into this. In fact, really, my whole career, which started right before the financial crisis in 2008, gold, especially back then, because it had some price momentum, and then people for the first time saw the government create $900 billion was the first bailout that was just unfathomable. Of course, that seems very small today. That's less than half of the most recent American Rescue Plan that has been passed. So
I haven't even thought about
it. It's funny how in 12 years, $1 trillion has become pretty standard for.
There's some inflation right
there.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, there has been inflation in government spending, no doubt. So that was a very common topic. People wanted to hold gold, whether it was physically, whether it was through an ETF like GLD. When I look at the evidence for that, there have been times. So the late 1970s, gold really performed well. And that was an inflationary environment. And I think that's why a lot of people who lived through that time associate gold as a good inflation hedge. I think the people who are in the business of selling gold have also done a good job of putting that narrative out there. And of course, they're talking their book and they're incentivized to sell fear to get you to buy gold, right? But when you actually look at the evidence, gold has not been really that great of an inflation hedge. There's some great academic research in the Financial Analyst Journal that went back over hundreds of years and showed that gold is less correlated to inflation than you might think. It's more volatile than you might think. So, and then even more recently, periods of high inflation, late 1980s, early 1990s, gold actually had a negative return when inflation was quite high. There are actually, in my view, better vehicles to hedge against inflation. TIPS is one, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. And some other commodities like oil actually have done a better job hedging against inflation historically.
So the digital corollary to gold is Bitcoin. Why should I not load up on Bitcoin for my digital store value in a digital currency world?
It's a lot of digitals. So if you buy the thesis that Bitcoin is a good store of value, sure, I guess you could buy it under that idea. I don't think we have enough evidence to say that Bitcoin is a great store of value at this point. We've talked about Bitcoin a lot in the past. In fact, the last time we talked about Bitcoin was early April. We've seen inflation pick up pretty significantly. And Bitcoin is down 41% since that time.
I believe the last one or the second to last squared away we did, we did it around cryptos. And since then, I know we're smart, but we look really smart right now.
Oh, you're going to get all the crypto people angry at us.
No. I still think, again, I mean, go back and listen to it. Yeah. We make the case for both sides. But to your point, in that short period of time, since we talked about it, what did we?
There are reasons to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Most of them really all of them, in my view, are speculative reasons. If you want to make a bet, if you want to have some fun, if you maybe really believe in the technology and it's the future, I'm not convinced of that, as I've said in the past. But the idea that you're going to buy it as an inflation hedge is a little bit laughable to me because it's just like saying that, you know, you're buying Bitcoin because in the future we're all going to buy and sell in Bitcoin. That's just, there's not really a scenario you can paint for me that makes me think that's likely versus the US dollar.
It tends to fall into an alternative category rather than an inflation hedge category.
Absolutely. Yes.
On the typically opposite end, if you will, from a speculative Bitcoin type investment, you get fixed income, which should be a safe investment. Talk about fixed income in an inflationary environment.
When you think about asset classes that do poorly in inflationary environments, probably the worst one you can think of is long-term fixed rate bonds. Let's think about kind of the math around that. The U.S. 30-year treasury bond today yields about 2.06%. So you put $100,000 in there, you're going to get 2.06% per year, and you're going to get your principal back in 30 years, 2051. If inflation runs at 3%, which is just long run historic average, let's say 3%, not even higher than would be normally expected, you're going to lose about 25% of your real purchasing power over that 30-year period. And people think about U.S. Treasury bonds as a risk-free investment. They're risk-free to the extent that the U.S. government is almost certainly not going to default on your debt, but they're not risk-free in the sense that you're going to get back more purchasing power when your bonds mature than what you put in.
If I don't want to do U.S. Treasuries, but I want to keep fixed income, why shouldn't I load up on Treasury inflation protected securities then, or TIPS?
I think TIPS are a good choice to help protect bond portfolios against inflation. They're not perfect. And I think there are some misconceptions for people who don't really understand how TIPS work. When you buy a TIPS bond, there is an embedded level of inflation assumed when you buy that TIPS bond. And that embedded inflation assumption is just what the market assumes inflation will be going forward. So that number is higher today than it was a year ago. That's why TIPS have performed well, which has been good for us because we increased our weighting last year to TIPS. But what they're really protecting against more than anything is unexpected inflation, not a general level of inflation. So if the market is correct, let's say TIPS are pricing in 3% inflation and you get 3% inflation, the return you're going to earn from your TIPS bond is equivalent to what you would get from a normal U.S. Treasury bond. It is only in cases of unexpectedly higher inflation where TIPS really protect the portfolio.
So that's why they've done better this last year, is we've seen higher than expected inflation. Am I hearing
that correctly? That's exactly right. So if you look at bond returns, the Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Index is down a little over 1%. TIPS bonds are up a little bit over 1%. So you've gotten 200 basis points.
You mean 2021 so far,
I'm sorry,
right?
2021. We're in 2021. Yes.
Everyone wants to forget 2020. So speak to the role of a fixed income portfolio in a macro sense in an inflationary environment then.
I think it is reasonable to think about your fixed income portfolio today and perhaps consider avoiding or reducing exposure to some segments of the market. Again, I think it's really hard to make a case for buying 30-year U.S. Treasury bonds unless you have a very out-of-consensus view that interest rates are going to decline. If they do, you're going to be rewarded handsomely for that. And that kind of goes to my next point, which is we have to have enough humility in our ability or anyone else's ability to forecast the future. So that's why, as we've said in the past, and Dex and I talk about it a lot, the evidence tells us that making big bets based on assumptions about the future is a really risky endeavor. So I think it's better to think probabilistically. To kind of flesh that out, let's assume, just using made up numbers, that we think there's about a 60% chance of inflation that ranges from 3 to 5% over the next 5 years. Maybe there's a 20% chance that it's below 3%, and 10% that it's above 5%, and 10% that we have deflation. Again, just making up numbers, those probably aren't quite right. But
it works to kind of frame the discussion.
Exactly. So that's the way, I and Dexter think about how we might make a change to a portfolio. We have a base case assumption that that led us last spring to increase our TIPS weighting because we saw what the government was doing. We thought, hey, there could be a chance that inflation is higher than expected based on this. So we increased our TIPS weighting. That didn't mean that we went 100% TIPS bonds because it could have gone a different way, right? The way I think about the future is always, this is the base case. Here are the other possibilities. Let's make sure that if a non-base case scenario comes to pass, that portfolios are still okay. But if the base case does happen, then our portfolios are positioned to benefit from that.
I think about it in terms of it's not like we're going to just go U.S. large value 100%.
Exactly.
I mean, you guys might put a different flair on it, but I think that's an easy way for investors to grasp it is we're simply, to your point, taking a base case and saying, okay, here are the options, and you're putting an evidence-based approach to it.
Right. Tyler mentioned U.S. large value. We haven't really spoke on equities. If you would, just kind of talk about, again, equities in an inflationary environment.
Stocks have kind of a mixed record when you look at inflationary environments. In times of high inflation and a recession, so if you had late 70s where you have oil prices spiking and you've got a recession, that's a bad environment for stocks because their input costs are going up, but demand for products and services is going down. So that's a tough environment for stocks. In more demand pull inflation, where you've got an economy that's really expanding faster than expected, stocks tend to hold up pretty well in that environment. And if you think about the difference between stocks and bonds, you're getting a fixed coupon rate typically. Stocks are companies that have the ability to go in and raise prices in response to market inputs. So, you know, if their labor costs go up, which is one thing that another thing that we're seeing that's kind of good and bad at the same time, companies can go in and raise prices. And that helps them defend against inflation in a way that bonds can't necessarily do. There are also some differences in how particular sectors might perform in inflationary environments. The energy sector tends to do pretty well. If you look at 2021 year to date, the energy sector is up over 40%. It's the best performing sector. So all that is kind of consistent with the inflationary themes that we're talking about.
I know if I give you more time, you could fill it. But Zach, thanks for the insight. Tyler, I'm going to turn it over to you here and see what you have in store for us for a listener question.
I think one area that an investor is feeling this is not only their portfolios, but just every day. Waking up, driving their car, getting on Zillow. Couple questions, like give me some examples of where we're seeing this price increase, where we're feeling it. And then my next question would be, should I sell my house and sell my car? Because all I'm hearing is my house is worth way more. And oh, you have a used car. Yeah, your used cars are going for record amounts right now. So where are we feeling it? And then I think a lot of people are, well, I'm going to sell my house and it's going to be great. I'm going to make all this money.
Well, I'll start with your first question. A couple of my favorite examples of how we're seeing inflation play out in the economy. Back in April, Hawaii kind of reopened to tourism. There was such a demand for rental cars that at one point in Maui, the cheapest rental car you could find was $722 a day for a Toyota Camry, which is a great car, but $722 right. a day, you rent it for too long, you could probably buy a Camry for that amount. So the interesting thing, the kind of funny thing, and this is shows you how people are smart and markets find a way. Some guy figured out that he could rent a U-Haul for 30 or 40 bucks a day and it was cheaper. So that's
imagine pulling up to the luau in a U-Haul.
So that started a trend of people going to Hawaii and renting U-Hauls as their vehicle to get around the islands. So
that's great.
That's, you know, that's one example. Another one is Shadow Creek Golf Course out in Vegas, which is a I've gotten to play a couple times. Cool golf course. Used to be $500 to play around out there, and it's kind of a cool experience. They announced this last week, they're doubling their green fee to $1,000, which makes it, I think, the most expensive kind of just round of golf in the country that, you know, the public can go play. And I think that just is emblematic of the level of demand for travel, for experiences that I think so many of us feel coming out of the coronavirus. So I would not be surprised to see other companies that are in high demand start to raise prices. However, I will say, and back to your point on used cars, markets do find a way to work.
Right.
And we've seen that with things like lumber prices that have come down significantly. And the profit incentive mechanism works as well. So as you said, people who might have that used car lying around that they're not using, it's a great time to go sell it. That sure. brings more supply in the market and that helps normalize prices. As far as selling your house, I think the problem there is if you sell your house, unless you're going to go buy an RV and travel around or buy a sailboat.
Rent an apartment.
Yeah, rent an apartment. Unless you really want to downsize, you're faced with buying something right. else that is yeah. likely to have appreciated a lot in value. You know, I do think we see that sort of trade pretty regularly from yeah. geographically. So you'll see people move from California to Arizona, which Arizona relative to Oklahoma is an expensive housing market relative to California. It's a cheap housing market. So,
well, and I read an article this week about the masses moving from California, maybe specifically San Francisco, to Austin, Texas, and how that just simply that is driving up the Austin. That would do it in any environment. It's going to drive up the prices, let alone the environment we're in
right.
now where, yeah, you want to build a house. Oh, it's going to cost you, you know, 10 times as much as it normally would.
Exactly. So. And think about how Austin feels relative to Oklahoma City. Very expensive very, housing yeah. market. Yes. Yeah. Relative to San Francisco. Very cheap.
So if you're listening and you're out there, come on. Come on.
Yes. We'll take it. Lots of land here and much cheaper housing prices than.
From an investor listener side, I think those are my, you know, initial thoughts when we start talking about this.
Yeah. Anything we missed there, Zach?
You know, the last thing I'd leave everyone with is thinking about portfolio returns in the context of inflation.
Mm. You're speaking real, not necessarily nominal.
Correct. And I think that's something that clients and even advisors haven't really had to think much about. Inflation hasn't been high enough that we've had to worry about the difference between nominal returns or pre-inflation and real returns, which is after inflation returns. Particularly because we've enjoyed double-digit annualized rates of returns from stocks over the last decade. But Let's assume for a moment that rates of return normalize over the next decade. Let's say you get 10% returns from stocks, which is near a long-run average. We know with where we are in interest rates, rates of return are going to be below historic norms. So let's say 2 or 3%. For a portfolio that has 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds, you're looking at, you know, 7 to 8% returns at best there.
Mm-hmm.
Those are nominal numbers I'm talking about. So if inflation were to run at 4%, all of a sudden you're down to that 3.5%, 4% real rate of return area.
Yep.
And then if you've got portfolio withdrawals, that's, you know, you're taking money out. So I think it's important to for everyone, for advisors, for end investors, to think about how inflation might affect portfolios and then to take that into account when you're planning on how you invest your money, how much money to take out over time, those sorts of things. And I think it's wise to be a little bit conservative and prudent.
Okay, I know we're running out of time, but I thought of one more. In something we've talked about lately, and not short term. I think short term investors that are in retirement or entering a withdrawal phase, or this is a different conversation. We've got to get creative. We got to use some, maybe be a little more aggressive. Long term, though, some investor that walks into our office, or an investor we're meeting with, a client we're meeting with, and they have, they have at least 15, 20 years of until they would ever really need it or touch it, and they're sitting on cash, a portion. Do they invest it all right now? Do you suggest they dollar cost average it in where you put in some every month? And what I think the answer is that we want them to invest for the long term, and the long term the markets are efficient, and we're not trying to beat a day-to-day inflation number.
Correct. The evidence tells us that markets go up over time. If you buy a stock today, chances are it's going to be worth more tomorrow. That's only about a 51% chance. If you look out 10 years, and when I say a stock, I'm talking about the stock market generally, it's almost, you know, your 90 plus percent chance that it's going to be worth
right.
more. So yes, I agree with you that the evidence tells us we should get that money invested quickly. There are cases where a client may have some concerns about investing at a particular point in time. The thing I always tell a client is at the end of the day, it's your money. If you are going to feel such regret and not be able to sleep at night, if we invest your $1 million today, and the market drops 10%, 15% over the next 3 months, we can invest it more slowly.
Sure.
Just know that that on average is a inferior strategy to going ahead and investing the full amount of money.
Until next time, fair winds and falling seas.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.